you want a vision of the future, Winston, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Someone is trying to teach me a lesson in futility. Why am I the only one who isn't killed?
They will run you dizzy. They will pile falsehood on top of falsehood until you can't tell a lie from the truth and you won't even want to. That's how the powerful keep their power. Don't you read the papers?
The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale.
It has been since man crawled out of the slime.
Welcome to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It is my pleasure to have Alan Buddle back on the show. Of course, Alan is the host of the Alan Buddle radio program. Correct? That's the name of it?
Alan Buddle radio show. Radio or show. Whatever you like to call it.
Okay. And that's carried on. Where can people find that?
Oh, you can find it through podcast.com. If you could just type in Alan Buddle radio show, or you can find it through Google or whatever. It's a long, strange URL, but yeah, you know, you can find my work, and hopefully there's a link to the podcast through this episode as well. Hopefully,
yeah, I'll provide a link so make it easy. Okay, well, recently you did an episode, "The Synagogue of Satan: Irish Republicanism and Zionism," and you kind of explore this interesting Jewish involvement in Irish Republicanism and its roots. Or links to the Zionist movement, particularly on this character, Rabbi Isaac Herzog, Robert Emmett Briscoe, and, of course, Eamon de Valera. A lot of people who are familiar with Irish history, that's a very common name, Eamon de Valera, the first president of the Irish Republic. And, of course, other characters you bring up, like Michael Collins, we're aware of through history and movies and this stuff. So this kindred, almost kindred spirit between the Irish Republicanism, the Revolution, Irish revolutionaries or insurgents, and also Zionism in the 19th century. What did you find?
Well, I mean, I just found an incredible number of people at the very top of the Irish Republican movement who were involved in very much armed militia activities, including gun running and, you know, the training of guerrilla forces and things like this, being actually of supposedly Jewish descent. And I say, I use Jewish in the way that they're understood today, but, you know, as sort of Revelation tells us, these are synagogue of Satan, but they call themselves real Jews, but they're not actually Jews, sort of thing. So I'll call them Jews for the sake of sort of the episode, so people can understand what I'm saying. But we have people like, for example, Robert Briscoe, who was very, very active in gun running for the IRA, but also he was very, very active, especially in the United States, raising money for the Irgun, which were the military wing of the sort of revisionist Zionist movement that were that decided they were going to use military and guerrilla warfare terrorist tactics to force Jewish immigration into what was then mandated Palestine. So we have also a lot of very interesting connections with regard to the rabbinical world and the Irish Republican movement, because there was a rabbi who was the chief rabbi of he was first chief rabbi of Belfast, then Dublin, and then the chief rabbi of Ireland, and he was known as the Sinn Féin rabbi, and his full name was Rabbi Yitzhak Harlevi Herzog, but he was known as Isaac Herzog, and he was basically very active in supporting the Irish Republican movement. And after the death of the previous Ashkenazi chief rabbi of British Mandate Palestine, he became the chief rabbi of British Mandate Palestine and then Israel after it, you know, achieved its official statehood sort of thing. So he was obviously a very, very important character in the rabbinic world. And this is backed up by the fact that his son became the president of Israel itself. And he was actually the sixth president of Israel. And we also have other, for example, another interesting connection is the, obviously Eamon de Valera and Isaac Herzog and Robert Briscoe worked very, very closely together. And they were sort of best of friends throughout, obviously, the wars and the formation of the state. And Eamon de Valera and Isaac Herzog were sort of fundamental in the writing of the Irish Constitution as well. And basically, sort of in every facet of this Irish Republican movement, we see sort of Jewish involvement, Jewish in quotes involvement. Another very interesting character that I found was a guy called Erskine Childers. Now, Erskine Childers was described as a major gunrunner for the IRA, and he died in 1922. But he basically was he's the great 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 grandson of a prominent Sephardic Jewish banker called Samson Gideon, who was described as the Rothschilds of his day and was a very sort of prominent character in British politics and this kind of thing, and supported, for example, a bill called the Jew Bill of 1753. This is obviously going a long way back, but this Erskine Childers, he's the father of who became the fourth president of Ireland, Erskine Hamilton Childers. So he was obviously very, very, very much a part of this international establishment. So I found it extremely interesting that although obviously it was the British with the the capturing of Palestine from the Ottoman Empire during the First World War, and obviously with the signing of the Balfour Declaration being written to Lord Rothschild from the British Foreign Secretary Arthur Balfour, you'd be forgiven for thinking that actually it was the British that were the more kind of would be more sort of pro-Zionist sort of thing than the Irish, but or people that are representing Republican Ireland, which was obviously in direct conflict with the British, supposedly British establishment, but actually that isn't the case, and we have sort of huge Zionist a huge connection between the movement for Irish republicanism and the movement for Zionism, and so there's many other characters I can delve into as well. I mean, obviously James Connolly is a major figure, and he was supposedly martyred as a result of the failed Easter Rising of I believe 1918. Was it 1918? 1916.
1916. Yeah, that was 16.
Yeah, sorry. But he was sort of, he had people like Vladimir Lenin describe him as sort of the greatest European socialist of his era, and upon his death, Leon Trotsky actually wrote a letter to his daughter. Saying that he'd become aware of the news and he offers his heartfelt sympathy sort of thing, and this is completely there are so many connections with known internationalist Jewish movements, of which I believe Bolshevism and Zionism provide just two of those examples that are today supposed to be in conflict with each other, but I believe they're two facets of what is the same establishment. You know, there are many other characters I can go into. For example, Estella Solomons, who was part of a very prominent family, a Jewish family in Dublin, who was, used to smuggle arms to the IRA through her vegetable patch as Stuart Rosenblatt, who is one of the leading Jewish Irish historians, sort of gleefully recalls sort of thing. And, you know, the way I'm going about my research here is by literally just taking everything from the horse's mouth, and not being controversial, not trying to put pieces together that aren't there, but actually trying, to see what they're saying. And the only controversial thing is the kind of what I would see, the obvious conclusions that I'm coming to. I don't know if you want to cut in or...
Well, if I recall, if I'm correct, the Jewish population in Ireland never amounted to more than a few thousand, correct?
Supposedly, it topped about 5,000, yeah.
The official, and that's, I think, today it's down to like 2,000 or 2,500, and it's dropped as low as 1,600. But as you're suggesting, is you have a lot of crypto Jews.
Of course, yeah. Because, you know, this is, I mean, a lot of Jews came out. Well, I say a lot. We don't really know how many. We never, you know, because another thing about the history, obviously, with Britain, there was the British expulsion of Jews in 1290, mm-hmm. which meant that they had to had to get out of the country. Apparently, still some went undercover even in those days, but even during that period of expulsion, they were able to move into parts of Ireland that weren't occupied, occupied by the British, mm-hmm. or controlled by the British, in order to exist elsewhere in Ireland under sort of non-British control, let's say. So there has been a Jewish presence in Ireland, you know, as far back as we can see, really, from even before the British expulsion. So
it goes back to the Norman conquest, right?
Yeah, I mean, there were suggestions that the first Jews that came to Ireland were in the 11th century, and that they were sort of sent away again. But by the 13th century, there's documented evidence to suggest that there is a Jewish presence in Ireland at that point. But you know, I haven't delved into all the obviously source material or anything like that regarding the sort of dim and distant history of this subject, but
you have this Jewish enthusiasm for revolutionary activity, which is a constant, you know, I guess, pattern in Jewish behavior going at least 2,000 years, to the days of Jesus Christ when he was crucified. What would you say? I mean, obviously, I think the official narrative or accepted narrative, this would be this, why would Jews support, they take up such a small percentage of the Irish population, yet there's a disproportionate role, they're yet again, another disproportionate role they're playing in a revolutionary cause. And I guess they would say this is the Jewish penchant for supporting the underdog revolution, these things. But then I guess you suggest there's ulterior motives here?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of evidence to suggest that they're not really the underdogs. You know, they're extremely prosperous. They actually are, you know, even under British rule in Ireland, they were extremely wealthy and formed some of the most wealthy families in Ireland at the time. And it didn't stop these families from involving themselves in the revolutionary movement, despite the fact that they were sort of very successful under supposedly British rule. I think it is a trait of this synagogue of Satan to create revolution, because they can always profit from a revolution. They can always gain more control, more money. Although I don't think the objective is ever really money. It's working towards their, you know, final world vision of the enslavement of the rest of mankind.
Yeah, that's an unfortunate stereotype, is that Jews being greedy and they hoard money. But Jews historically have been very generous in supporting organizations or causes which are amenable or at least consistent with their interests. They write big checks.
Oh, yeah, yeah, very much so. I mean, obviously,
much more so than Gentiles, actually. That
springs to mind. Well, yes, yeah. But it, obviously it begs the question, what kind of charity are they donating mm-hmm. to? And this kind of thing. And these are, you know, and I think the NGOs and charities of today are some of the most important things to get to the bottom of, because it's a way, obviously, to manufacture political change throughout the world.
Yeah, and Ireland, unfortunately, is a great example of that transformation through NGOs and corporations.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, you know, like for example, Amnesty International is sort of, you know, like one of these supposedly sort of anti-war, anti kind of imperialism kind of charities, you know, but it was set up by members of the Rothschild family mm-hmm. or a member of the Rothschild family. And you know, they're all these kind of organizations are very useful with regard to creating the public dialogue as well, because people would give a greater credence to an organization like Amnesty International than, say, if the British Foreign Office said something about yeah. another country or something like this. So there are, you know, there's a great reason why, you know, these charities are so prominent. And and, you know, in parts of the UK, the charity shops seem to do better than all the other shops on the high street. These are the companies that, I say companies, these are the organizations that people pour their money into, because you get, you know, cheap secondhand clothes and books and all this kind of stuff that they get for free.
Yeah.
They don't pay their staff, and they're using all that money to go and fund whatever activities their executive committee decide that, you know, is in their interest to, you know, to work towards. So I think that they play a big part in today's world.
The use of foundations, tax-exempt organizations, under the guise of philanthropy or charity by oligarchic interest to actually pursue their interests and also to bring about cultural, political, and economic change is, you know, well-founded. Mm-hmm. That's the Rockefellers did that back when they established mm-hmm. their foundation in the early 20th century. I mean, even Jewish criminals like Mo Dalitz, you know, who became legitimized through NGOs, if you will, foundations, you know, like ADL, and, you know, he was able mm-hmm. to leverage a part of his fortune and just, you know, revitalizing his reputation and also setting up various foundations. If you look at foundations, even like medical foundations, often they'll be named after a Jewish gangster.
Right, yeah.
You know, and you're thinking, you're reading some, you know, the news story or the news report, you know, refers to this foundation, and you I recognize the name, like, wait a second, this guy was a Jewish gangster. I mean, he's like,
yeah. You know? I was just listening to a really interesting talk by, what was it? The name will come to me, but he basically describes the Jewish involvement, or the Jewish mafia involvement also in Zionism, and people like Jabotinsky were directly in contact with people like Meyer Lansky, for example, and people like Longy Zwillman.
Was it like Ryan Dawson or something?
Sorry?
Was it Ryan Dawson?
No, it wasn't. It was a Jewish guy himself.
Oh, okay. That's even more interesting when they...
annoying. I can't remember his name, but... Yeah. Actually this guy said, you know, like, there's very little to choose between like a Jewish gangster in America and a revolutionary Zionist in Israel, sort of thing, because they have exactly the same mindset, and he said it himself, sort of thing. And I found that really interesting.
Going back to Ireland, you point out that, you know, Michael Collins received help from Jews covering up. I think the synagogue helped get him out of trouble one time. And also, Eamon Dave Valera, is he the one that they actually bought him a house?
Well, no, they bought Arthur Griffith's
house. Arthur Griffith, that's what I'm confused about. Yeah,
he's always raised by, you know, people that are talking about sort of Jewish activity in Ireland, and his example is always given of an example of anti-Semitic people that have ruled over Ireland, because he wrote a couple of articles back in the very early 20th century critical of Jews. But actually, he had a Jewish lawyer for his entire career, and it was a group of Jewish people who bought him a house after he got married. So, you know, it doesn't really hold up. And also, you know, this guy called Michael Noick, who was a very leading solicitor, who was solicitor for Arthur Griffith. He represented a lot of leading IRA figures in their court cases as well. So, you know, it's these kind of connections people often overlook, but I think it really matters that you know the people representing these revolutionaries were part of this, you know, synagogue, basically.
Well, it is a strategy for Jewish organizations or people to actually promote anti-Semitism, to create the idea that Jews are beleaguered and victimized. And you in this article, or in this episode rather, you point out the case of this book called The Moneylender.
Yeah.
And it's actually...
Yeah, that's right.
Want to talk about that? That's interesting.
Well, it is interesting. A guy called Joseph Edelstein. Uh-huh. I can't remember exactly when it was written now, but I think it went through 5 editions, if I remember rightly. And basically this book was... bearing in mind, this was at a time in Ireland where Jewish people would go door to door and try to get people to buy their goods on credit and basically get them in debt with them.
It's like the payday loans.
Exactly. Yeah. And sort of weak housewives would, you know, submit to, because maybe they've spent money where they shouldn't, you know, where their husband wouldn't have agreed with it or whatever. So they sort of... often behind their husband's back, would take out a loan to buy sort of amenities for the family or whatever.
But yeah, this is the credit card offer showing up in the mail today. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, exactly right. And so it was an understood phenomenon of this happening, and that the people doing it were Jewish. So this was a well-known thing. So, you know, but yeah, this guy, Joseph Edelstein, wrote a novel exactly on this subject called The Moneylender, which you can't get hold of, I don't think. I haven't been able to actually look at the text, but I do know about, I've seen comments on what this novel was. But this guy, Joseph Edelstein, was also involved in an organization that he set up, as well as a guy called Jacob Elian, I believe. Which was called the Judeo-Irish Home Rule Association. And this was an early sort of explicitly Jewish organization that was to promote home rule for Ireland, sort of thing, not, you know, and getting away from British rule. And this, you know, really, really fascinating. And this guy, Stuart Rosenblatt, calls... this Joseph Edelstein character, you know, a complete nutter. That's how he dismisses him, as a nutter. But this nutter was actually involved in the foundation of organizations with other people of the Jewish community. So I don't think he can quite so easily be ruled out as a nutter. And even in this book that I got called Jews in 20th Century Ireland by a Cork professor called Dermot Keogh, K-E-O-G-H, he sort of... Even in there, he says that some people sort of supposed that this attack on Jewish money lending was in fact a ploy by the Jews to make more money. But I suspect it was really a ploy to centralize money lending, sort of thing, and not have it be so obviously Jewish, because when they can hide behind their banks and their, you know, loan corporations or whatever, it's you know, isn't so in your face. It doesn't because you can't tell where those strategies are coming from, sort of thing. But back then people did understand that the people that knocked at their door were Jewish.
Well, they had an understanding of usury and it being traditionally kind of looked frowned upon in Christian society.
Yeah,
and it was only the Jews who practiced this stuff, and it was, you know, seen as being, rightly so, as being, you know, predatory and exploitative, and and it's also this is you have a propagandist, a Jewish propagandist, promoting Jewish negative Jewish stereotypes, which would go a long way in creating, I guess, resentment on the host community regarding Jews, and this in turn also creates group cohesion among the Jews, which enthrones, you know, the rabbinical tyranny, which is, you know, modern Judaism.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's I think the creation of anti-Semitism has been, I say, you know, use anti-Semitism as being anti the people that currently call themselves Jews, is being very beneficial, you know, for them.
Chaim Weizmann, the first president of Israel.
Obviously, the elephant in the room, of course, is the Nazi regime, of course.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and I don't think any sort of any movement has been so beneficial to the Jews as the Nazi regime in the long term. And it's my, you know, it's my stance that that was the realization of those long-term goals that were played out, you know, in accordance with their plan, sort of thing, you know, because ever since, any objective analysis of Jewish power is always associated with this, you know, horrendous Holocaust causing regime that we're not allowed to take any sympathy with or even consider the supposed views of, because that is basically you being as bad as a genocidal maniac. And so they've, you know, so objective analysis of Jewish power has never been the same since obviously the Second World War.
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot easier to characterize a Julius Streicher as a bad guy as opposed to maybe St. John Chrysostom or Hilaire Belloc, you know, some of these more sober earlier criticism of Jews, the Nazi era, which was took on a sort of a garish, cartoonish, you know, form because of its reaction. It was a reaction to something,
Yeah, exactly. And there are sort of publications today that are, you know, in a similar vein. And I think it obviously, to their fan base, they are obviously very popular and they say the things that people want to hear. But to regular, normal people, us, you know, like the general public in, you know, en masse, are going to react poorly to these kind of ways of expressing these ideas. You know, because they're kind of, you know, deliberately kind of offensive, or at least deliberately offensive to most people, I would say. So they really don't do a very good job of getting, you know, yeah, as you say, a sober, intelligent, rational, you know, point across about actually this group are, you know, the increase in their power is not good news for the rest of humanity, sort of thing. You know, and there, obviously there's many examples that can be given as to why that is the case.
I mean, yeah, there's a much criticism of Jewish power, and the Jewish question predates the Third Reich. You know, you had in 1890, you had the Catholic Church publish a series of articles in its magazine Civiltà Cattolica regarding the Jewish question. It was called The Jewish Question, and it talked about the problem of Jewish influence, just particularly regarding France. And it's from a Catholic perspective, but it came to the conclusion that as soon as France secularized, and, you know, during the Revolution, and you know, killed the monarchy and weakened the Church, it was going to be subjected to Jewish rule, and it explicitly says that, and it talks about the problems of Jewish domination of finance and their cultural influence and their corruption of Christian society, Pope Benedict's the 16th great uncle, who wrote around 1900 about the problems of Jews in Germany, and he said if they don't get their act together and straighten up, Germany's going to react by picking a leader. And they did pick a leader, didn't they? So again,
or a leader was picked for them. Maybe.
It was a dialectic. But the point is that the conditions were created. You know, the conditions in Weimar weren't anyone's imagination, and not just the economic conditions, but the cultural conditions.
Yeah, and it has to be seen in that context, the Hitler regime and what it offered, and the sort of the self-respect that it offered to the German people was as a direct result of how the Weimar Republic was so, you know, degenerate. you know, in every way, you know, and that's why, you know, that created the correct sort of foundation for this very different sort of movement sort of thing, because people were fed up with how it was. But that's always how you create change, isn't it? I mean, like, for example, in Ireland, you have the you know, the Jewish establishment controlling Britain and making life more and more, you know, I'm supposing here, but making life more and more difficult for Irish people and building up that resentment mm-hmm. for the British in order to provide the revolutionary movement to overthrow the British. But it's all part of the same contrived plot sort of thing. So you have the Jewish people in Britain working alongside the Jewish people in Ireland to foment this plan to basically divide and rule and create chaos and war.
Here's an interesting case you brought out in your talk was the so-called Irish potato famine, which really wasn't a famine per se. What happened was you had the blight regarding potatoes, but the British kept exporting the other food, so the Irish were relegated to potato crops. When that failed, they didn't allow the Irish to avail themselves of other foodstuffs, and they kept exporting. The export market was maintained to maintain the interest payments to Jewish bankers.
Right.
And at the same time, the Rothschilds, you talk about organize a relief effort.
Yeah, exactly. They probably used that same money to to masquerade as the heroes mm-hmm. and provide them aid after, you know, obviously after, I don't know, a huge percentage of their population died of hunger. You know, so, you know, this is not beyond these people. So, yeah, I mean, you know, when you see the Rothschilds, you know, heading some sort of philanthropic effort, then you got to ask yourself serious questions of what, you know, what is their agenda here? Because making life good for sort of white Christian people is certainly not one of their objectives. I found that really interesting. And it's an area that I haven't delved into in great depth as of yet, but you know, it's the evidence, you know, sort of, you know, it's uncontroversial that, you know, it was the very top money powers in Britain at the time were the ones behind this relief effort. So and this was also at the same time as when in Ireland Jewish people were given naturalization as full Irish citizens, and I don't believe that's a coincidence either. So why is it a priority for Irish people to naturalize Jews fully into their society during the worst famine in living memory, you know, when people are dying in their hundreds of thousands? It screams, you know, like that something else is going on here, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. And this issue of naturalization, full citizenship, now today we all live in modern liberal democracies, supposedly, and so the idea of citizenship is sort of just a matter of filling out the proper paperwork and giving some sort of superficial oath to the paper constitution and promise to be a good chap while you're but previously, and the United States is a problem. The United States is sort of a Freemasonic project. It's a proposition nation.
Yeah.
You know, so that's, we have, you know, but it was tempered. In fact, it was really decentralized until the 20th century. But I don't want to get into U.S. history about that, the complications regarding U.S. history and citizenship. But in Europe, it's a different matter. You have sort of integral societies. And the traditional understanding of Irish citizenship, I think to this day, technically, it's still you have to be, you know, of Irish blood, technically, although they've had a big immigration push now, pushed by a certain tribe. But this was an issue throughout Europe that started to get addressed in the 18th century, which is sort of this era of, I guess, beginning in the late 18th century, but in the 19th century, all the way to the early 20th century, so-called Jewish emancipation, when Jews got full citizenship in these countries. But traditionally, it was understood that Jews were are different, they were alien, and therefore they didn't play by the same rules, so certain different rules or restrictions applied to them, and perhaps they were prevented from getting certain posts in government or even for certain commerce. And traditionally, it was that it was said that Christians should be have certain separation from Jews because of the bad influence and this stuff. But as society became more secularized and liberalized, those notions became considered, you know, I guess passé or worse, just racist and but now we can't even talk in these terms because we live in an era where we're all just the same citizens and we can't make these distinctions anymore.
Yeah, and you know, the idea of a country being Christian is alien these days, you know, completely. The quote unquote Jews were, you know, like they were the idea was that they were given refuge often, you know, or almost, you know, the whole time when they arrived from somewhere
because they'd been kicked
out of somewhere else. You know, like. So why would you give these people that have just got kicked out of every, you know, some other place, why would you give them, you know, full equal rights to the people that were already living there and were full integrate, you know, full members of that community? It doesn't make any sense. Like, you know, it wouldn't make any sense if, you know, someone was kicked out of their house and you give them shelter and then you, you know, say, actually, you know, you've got just as right, much right to my house as I do, sort of thing. And you know, it doesn't make sense. Like, but yeah, obviously these kind of opinions are these days very, very unpopular.
Well, it's because Andrew Joyce makes the point. You're talking about Jewish history. It's all it's dominated. At least the accepted Jewish history, the official Jewish history, is virtually monopolized by Jewish historians. So it's very self-serving.
Yeah.
Anti-Semitism, the idea that 109 countries have, you know, at least 109 times they've been kicked out of host countries. This is all part of sort of pathological, racist, you know, just sort of
because of
the host
because
people.
We're just inclined to just evict people, sort of thing. We just hate people that are different, sort of thing. We hate people for being different, so we. So we don't offer them completely identical rights and opportunities as everyone else, sort of thing.
But they were always known, and this is, I mean, and in other contexts, Jewish historians would admit this, that Jews are involved in predatory finance, vices, alcohol production, prostitution, these things. So they got a reputation of not being trustworthy, just causing problems, and also being showing contempt for the host Christian culture, which is, you know, part of the Talmud.
Exactly. I mean, you know, it's just understanding, you know, who you're dealing with. You make sensible provisions to actually, the reason is to protect the people of your own culture, your own race, if you like, your own nation. It's for their protection that you don't offer this very, very tight-knit tribe equal rights, because eventually it won't be, you know, it's not equal for long because they have this sort of solidarity as a sort of small minority. They're a very, very tight-knit community and they always prefer to, you know, help each other out, sort of thing. You know, they, you know, we could take a lot of pointers from this tribe as to sort of solidarity. It's inter tribe solidarity, if you like, you know, because there's so many Jewish organizations and Jewish charities and all this kind of thing designed to help solely Jewish people. Mm-hmm. You know, and if I was to set up a hospital or a daycare center or a nursing home or anything like this explicitly for white people, I wouldn't be allowed. I'd probably be thrown in prison, or at least the place would get closed down and, you know, I'd be ruined. But obviously, because they hide under the guise of religion and race and tribe and ethnicity and whatever, they get around all these.
Yeah, they're all those and none of them at the same time.
Yeah, exactly. they can pick and choose what they are according to the circumstances. But yeah, you just need to look. I mean, you know, anyone in the audience, you just look up how many Jewish organizations there are, specifically Jewish organizations. It's staggering. It's really staggering. You know.
Yeah, it was Andrew Joyce.
And then try and find one white one.
Yeah, as Andrew Joyce says, Andrew Joyce says, they're the groupiest group that ever grouped. but they
yeah, exactly.
But they deny that solidarity, any expression of that solidarity among the host society, you know, if you will, the white group, you know, solidarity, or even Christian groups or that. You know, they'll engage in litigation, preventing Christian schools from hiring Jewish teachers or homosexuals, stuff like that. But you know, but you try to, can a Christian teach at a yeshiva school?
Yeah, good luck.
You know,
yeah, exactly.
Good luck doing that. If you know, I just want to cause trouble, you know, why would they? But they, and that's what they do. But what they've successfully done is, and in the name of liberty and personal freedom, enlightenment ideas, they've atomized society where we don't even identify in those terms. So there's no collectivity to organize around anymore among the majority, which then can be picked apart because they're allowed to organize. And like, this isn't fantasy, you know. Is the World Jewish Congress a fantasy? Is that something of my perverse imagination I dream of? Is the ADL, B'nai B'rith, or even Israel, the Mossad, just a figure
World Zionist Organization, or the Chabad Lubavitch, or we could pick any number of organizations, couldn't we? But they're not figments of your imagination, I assure you.
No,
they're very much real.
And no, this is interesting because this. You in your episode, you talked about how the Jewish role in the Irish, the creation of the Irish Free State and the Irish Republic, Ireland's independent Ireland, and the writing of its constitution. And in that constitution, there is an explicit grant of religious freedom, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And the Jews support that.
Yeah, and it was in fact Rabbi Isaac Herzog that was personally consulted by. I mean, this is even openly, for all I know, he could have written the whole thing. But even openly, he was consulted in the writing of this part of the Constitution, which explicitly, as you correctly say, gives religious freedom, supposed religious freedom to the Jewish community. So,
for most people, that's not problematic. And I would say superficially, it doesn't appear to be problematic because most of us don't believe in coercion, making people, worship a certain, belief they don't believe, a God they don't believe in, or making people go to church. This is all very, very, way back then for modern liberal societies. But what you see is when you establish a country of Ireland, which is, Catholic, and if there's any country that you could have established an official Catholic country with an official religion, it should have been Ireland. But it wasn't. That wasn't so because it was sort of established as a liberal democracy, and liberal democracies make certain promises. Abide by the rule of law. You have a Bill of Rights, and you have courts of law, and these things. It all sounds very tidy and very mature and very clean. But at the end of the day is a liberal democracy, because it's not integral, doesn't have like an idea of a national religion or a culture, is very porous. It's very open to infiltration and control. It's what we've seen in the United States, we've seen in the liberal states, is the destruction of the integral state and the creation of a liberal democracy, where then oligarchs come in, many of a large proportion of which are Jews, come in and take over because they're the ones who maintain their solidarity, and they network and they control, and they can more or less bribe and control because they have control of the banking system and the entertainment system, the news system, publications, newspapers. So there's at the end of the day, liberalism is a lie anyway. It's just a front for Jewish oligarchic control.
Yeah, exactly. And this it sort of got me thinking about the propagation of anti-Semitism again, because if you can have sort of a supposedly anti-Semitic rhetoric in the mainstream, that gives the illusion or sort of that. That makes people come to the false conclusion that they don't completely control the media. So, they can hide behind all this supposedly anti-Semitic stuff. I mean, I think we were talking about the, inter-tribe solidarity and stuff, and how our societies have become very fractured and atomized, as you correctly say. But while our society is genuinely atomized, they give the perception of atomization or the perception of disunity, because that is very much in their interest. And I think the sort of these days, the sort of Zionist versus anti-Zionist duality is one of those examples that, in fact, this is a very useful sort of a popular conflict and one which they control both sides of. The left side, which is sort of explicitly anti-Zionist, is sort of very Marxist and very part, you know, very communist sort of thing. And then you've got the more nationalist right-wing, much more on the side of Zionism, as we see it play out in that dynamic all over the world. But if you look at the people that are at the very forefront of pushing anti-Zionism, then they're just as Talmudic and tribe orientated as the Zionists are. And you have sort of I can't remember the name of the we have all Orthodox Jewish groups taking part in major anti-Zionist events and all this kind of thing, you know. And I think that's just a
Some people refer to it
as a false dialectic.
Some people refer to it as we're trapped in the kosher sandwich.
Right.
Is it Zionism or Bolshevism? You know, or is it socialism or international capitalism? But it turns out it's the same thing. It's the same group.
Exactly.
Pushing
capitalism is made so unpopular by the unfairness in the way that they run it in order to very successfully promote anti-capitalism, which is much more in tune with their ultimate objectives, I think. The abolition of private property, which, you know, that is part of where we're heading, you know, communalization of everything. I always dispute that we have capitalism. I don't think we have capitalism, because in a capitalist system, the capital sort of rules, if you like. But it's obviously not like that at all with government and private government contracts and all this other corruption. It makes a capitalist system impossible. So while you have money changing hands and lots of people getting very rich, it doesn't mean it still doesn't qualify as being a capitalist system, because there's so much inherent sort of corruption. We have a system of usury.
Obviously a debauched currency, an occulted corrupt banking system. You can't have a free market or market. The market economy has its place. You need price discovery. You need entrepreneurship and these things. But you have this inordinate concentration of wealth brought about by usury and also manipulation of the banking system, which was set up to bring about this very, you know, result that we're seeing today under the guise of capitalism. I believe it, you know, I believe in capitalism with a human face. What I mean by that is a moral order. There's no progress outside the moral order. And it's interesting. It gets back to the point I was talking about, the idea of the Jews supporting their Ireland, you know, with free exercise of religion and freedom of religion. In the United States, that's been used to destroy religious influence, to create what is called a naked public square. It's freedom from religion. They use the First Amendment here, at least an interpretation of the First Amendment. We have no establishment clause. That really only explicitly applies to the federal government. But since then, the courts have interpreted in a way that seeks to expunge religious influence from the public square, which is ever expanding, so you increasingly push it, you marginalize it. At the same time, the idea of religious freedom tends to more or less keep religion at the margins, because basically everyone can practice their own religion as long as you just do it on Sunday, don't let it impede you the other 6 days during the week, then it's okay.
Yeah.
So religion has no real influence, really. It's just it's pushed aside. That's the trick of America. But it's all under the guise of religious influence. But Jews have always advocated, under the First Amendment of the United States, religious freedom. And what they mean by that, and one character in the United States was Leo Pfeffer. He was a lawyer for the American Jewish Committee, or Congress. And he was big in some of the litigation in the 60s and 70s that worked to, you know, keep prayer out of public schools and create what he called the naked public square. And he was a big advocate of secular humanism. Basically, that religion has no place in public life. And the only problem is when you create that vacuum is going to get filled by something. And, of course, someone's values are going to prevail. And that was ultimately his objective. But he always talked in terms of religious freedom and liberty and these things, but his real motivation was an antipathy towards Christianity, particularly Catholicism. Yeah. And he wrote about that in his memoirs. He hated driving by the Catholic schools, rather, and seeing the boys and girls lined up in their uniforms and how many of them were. So he wanted to weaken the Catholic Church. And he saw the Catholic Church as being monolithic and strong. And he had no problem with the Catholic Church if it was weak.
The point
is in under the guise of liberty, they've atomized everybody. They've weakened society, destroyed organic communities where people have no mediating institutions to help govern and control their lives, and they become, you know, sort of mindless zombie consumers for products that the corporations can provide at interest, you know.
Yeah, exactly. I agree.
That's the type of society they've created. Now, Ireland is, recently what's occurred in Ireland, with the referendum regarding abortion and gay marriage.
Yeah,
exactly. As recently as 1993, Ireland had a law that homosexuality was actually a crime.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the thing. They want to get religion out of law, don't they?
Yeah.
As much as anything. Because, you know, when you do that, sooner or later the law becomes in line with the Talmud. Basically. So first you have to get rid of supposed religious interference in legal matters, when in fact there shouldn't be any difference between, in a Christian nation, the laws of the land should reflect the Christian beliefs sort mm-hmm. of thing. Obviously that makes, but obviously that doesn't fit in with the agenda of these people, so they want to destroy everything that Christianity represents, sort of thing, and enforce the Talmud, and obviously they're sort of pushing the Noahide laws as well, aren't they, in the UN, mm-hmm. sort of very, very silently. What they really want is the imposition of international Jewish law on the world. Why can't we get Talmudism out of international law? That would be good. But it doesn't work the other way around, does it?
No.
as we well know.
I make a point here in the United States, whenever so often we have a gentleman or a lady appointed to the federal bench, become a federal judge, and during the confirmation hearings, and if that appointee happens to be Catholic, inevitably, he or she will be confronted with usually a Jewish senator on the Judiciary Committee asking them about their dogma and faith, and will impinge upon their will influence their decisions in court, the decisions they render. And but when Ruth Bader Ginsburg or four of the Jewish justices who are now sitting on the Supreme Court, when they were getting their confirmation hearings, no one asked them if the Talmud would affect their judicial.
Well, exactly.
Yeah. Decisions. Exactly.
It's all very one-sided.
Yes.
All the time. And often the people presenting themselves as Catholic will do so in a way to sort of, so they'll sort of apologetically say, no, my Catholic beliefs don't have anything to do with performance as a.
Won't infect my judicial
Lord justice or whatever.
Yeah, because we have this myth that judges are these legalistic high priests who look at the law objectively, and they somehow create no bias involved in their decision making. When most Supreme Court decisions are highly politicized, and for one reason or another, it's a joke.
Yeah, absolutely.
But we maintain that myth because we put them in black robes and we put them in temples.
Just like you put a white coat on a person and people think they have valuable medical advice.
Yes, you're scientific. But what happened since the 90s, since the era of the Celtic Tiger, because you had in the 90s, Ireland emerged economically finally after a century or 60 years in the doldrums. A lot of reasons for that. But in the 90s, it emerged as they call it the Celtic Tiger. And it opened itself up to international finance and corporations under the guise of create jobs, modernize Ireland. Not really an explicit social agenda behind it, but nevertheless, the social agenda was enforced eventually through the corporations and NGOs that filtered into Ireland. But they had this big boom in the 90s and the 2000s, and then that bubble popped in 2008, and they found out they weren't really wealthy. They were just in debt, and they were just living off credit. And the real estate plummeted, and then the Irish state bailed out the banks, which I think necessitated a big loan from the EU at interest, and then at a high interest rate, which now the Irish taxpayers are not paying. Those who were foreclosed upon didn't get to keep their house, but the banks got to sell the houses, so they all made money. It was that same scam that occurred here in the United States, the bank bailouts. But throughout this whole process, Ireland went through this sort of alchemical process. It was sort of, its culture was destroyed. Its traditional culture was destroyed. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the influence was because Ireland created this really low corporate tax rate, which brought in all these corporations, which promised to hire Irish citizens. They ended up bringing a bunch of foreigners, and it was through the high-tech companies like Google, and they came in, and they had a big influence in Irish culture through social media and changing its culture. But at the same time, and this is interesting, is that although the Irish technically only account for a few thousand people in Ireland, they have a very prominent role in universities and in the government there. And a few of these characters, there's an article by Andrew Joyce who kind of exposes some of these characters. One is Ronit Letton, who was a sociologist, associate professor of sociology at Trinity College in Dublin until her retirement in 2014. From 1997 to 2012, Lennart was the head of sociology and acted as director of the Trinity Immigration Initiative, from which she advocated an open-door immigration policy for Ireland and opposed all deportation, as well as engaging in activism to liberalize Irish abortion laws. That's another thing you see Jews always supporting.
Yeah. Another fancy way of saying the genocide of the Irish people.
Yes. More interesting character is this guy, Alan Shatter. Alan Shatter was a justice. He was a justice official, but he could be. He was very important in changing Irish law. He was an Irish-born Jew, and he was very important in weakening its laws on the family. He supported the judicial separation of family law reform act in 1989, supported homosexual adoption, homosexual marriage, and also abortion rights. And was a very key figure in weakening its immigration laws and bringing in some of the migrants that have created such a problem in Ireland now with crime and these things. Another one is Laura Weinstein, a New York PhD who now lives in Ireland and claims to be an expert in Irish history. She claims that Ireland really doesn't really exist as a race. It's a figment of everyone's imagination. Also, the promoting an Ireland, the Irish themselves are racist, and they're guilty of historical crimes. Now, of all the people in the world,
Irish as a race don't exist, but they're also as a race racist.
They're racist,
well.
So they're creating. She's importing white guilt into Ireland, which is very important in debilitating the ability of the host population to defend itself, from being erased.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't take much to you always stumble across the same Bergs, Steens, Baums at the bottom of all these kind of agendas, don't you? All across the world. And, obviously the MO is mimicked everywhere, and they're very, very predictable when you know what they're up to, because they're working towards this same, sort of multiculturalism in Europe and in majority white nations across the world. And so, there isn't a single country that is exempted from this plot, as far as I can see. And some countries are just going a little bit quicker than others. But there is.
Ireland, and this goes back to that question, if there is a recognition of this, of the uniqueness, or at least the alien nature of Jews. Now, this is admitted because central to the idea of Zionism, and this is what was stated with Zionism. What's his name? The founder of Zionism.
Herzl.
He said that the reality of Zionism means that all Jews belong to the Zionist state, no matter where they are, and their primary loyalty should be to that, and not their host country. So inevitably, with the reality of Zionism, you have an inherent question of dual or doubtful loyalty.
Okay. Yeah. And yeah, or crypto loyalty.
Crypto loyalty.
Yeah.
Now, in the past, and you mentioned when societies were, you know, overtly were explicitly Christian, or they're integral societies, this was, the people were aware of this, and people wrote about it. And therefore, certain laws and restrictions applied to them to at least limit the damage that the Jewish population could inflict on society, because people had an awareness of this. And, you know, prior to the Second World War, this could be enunciated in one degree or another.
Yeah, it could. Yeah, and it was.
Yeah. And it was. And, you know, look at people like distinguished figures like Hitler or Belloc wrote about this, you know, who's now
even Winston Churchill. Even Winston Churchill, yes, in his advocation for Zionism, used the idea that the exportation of Jews to Palestine would mean a diminishing Jewish power here, which was seen as a beneficial thing.
Yes.
So even people like Winston Churchill were saying these things.
And I'd argue that, you know, the Zionist state Israel is less of a problem than the diaspora, because the Zionist state creates a target for criticism, whereas the diaspora, they can blend in and say, we're just citizens, why are you picking on us? And they can organize other NGOs and foundations and corporations and banks, and they can coordinate, then they can disappear the moment any criticism comes their way.
Yeah, well, exactly. People don't even like to, you know, wonder how it was that this state got created in the first place. You know, was it just out of the goodness of people's heart that they, you know, the British handed Palestine to the Jews, or maybe more sensible people realize that no, it was just it's just a indication of just the amount of control that they have over Britain at the time.
Yeah, and also the publication. I mean, very important was the publication of the Schofield Bible.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And it shows just the level of influence they had just in publishing, and this was their attempt. You know, 20, 30 years before, or 40 years before the creation of the Israeli state. Manipulating the culture. I think this point they were targeting the evangelical Christians, because the Catholic Church
and associating themselves with the name Israel as well. Yeah. I believe, because I don't believe they're Israel at all. I think this is another very convenient deception, which obviously gave them the fake legitimization of their cause for the occupation of Palestine. As a stepping stone to world domination, you know, complete world government under their control, I believe. And I think the way that the international media, which is under their complete control, almost complete control, the way that outrage is being deliberately manufactured against Israel, it's clear to me that the state that we currently know as Israel, as a Jewish state, will not be part of this international global government. I think it will. I think Israel will, in its, you know, Israel will be collapsed, and it will then seem that the power of this tribe has been destroyed, sort of thing. Because they are manufacturing this, a lot of outrage for their own behavior towards these Palestinians, which they talk about in their media all the time. It's no coincidence that people who are absolutely clueless about the world in general have a very, very strong opinion, especially we're talking young left-wing, you know, for example, university educated people. They are very, very hot on the Israel-Palestine issue. Why is that? It's not because they've done any of their own research. They've been consuming Jewish-controlled media like everyone else, and Jewish-controlled propaganda through their universities. It's because that is the popular stance to take, just as being pro-homosexuality, pro-transgender, pro-multiculturalism. All these other things come hand in hand with sort of young people today who believe in the abolition of Israel. And I believe if they wanted the state of Israel to be this sort of untouchable beacon of, or be seen as this untouchable beacon of rights and justice and good treatment of all men, it would be seen as that, because that's how it would be presented in their media, in my submission. But that is not what I don't think that is the plan. I think that, you know, with the increasing outrage being manufactured against Israel, it seems to me that ultimately they plan to collapse it to bring about their next stage in global control. And with the collapse of the state of Israel, I believe they're trying to wipe out true Israel, which are the white people across the world. At least that's the way I see things at the moment.
Well, you have to see these things in stages and dialectics, and the difficulty is obviously the presentation we're given of the dual sides isn't the whole picture. It's like Torah politics, and even this most recent thing where President Trump supposedly ordered this missile attack to kill the Iranian Quds general in Iraq.
Yeah,
and why is that being? Is it really because he's a bad guy who's going to harm Americans, or is Donald Trump cornered because of impeachment, and now the Israeli lobby controls the Senate, and they can say if you don't do this, we'll impeach you, or is it again this very thing where they're trying to constantly stoke a conflict in the Middle East?
The West looking bad, isn't it? It's always the West looking bad, and we know that. We know who the West is really controlled by, but the reality is, to the international audience, it's white people that are to blame for the suffering of people across the world, and that's how it's being presented. The Chinese army of several million people will think they're doing a righteous thing in being anti-West, This division is going to go somewhere, and I think it's long been talked about a third world war, to bring about the new global system, and all indications seem as though that's a likely course of events at some stage or at some point or another. I don't know sort of when this is going to happen or even if this is going to happen, but it does seem that we're moving in that direction.
Well, it's similar to the fact that, slavery is always blamed on white people.
Sure, exactly. Exactly.
Despite the fact it's a universal practice, it's still practiced in Africa by non-white people, but yet it's the white people who get blamed for it, because they're the ones you can get reparations from or extract guilt or some sort of extortion.
They're innocent because they got the idea off white people, apparently.
Yeah. And of course, that's the only, it was the West only actually did away with chattel slavery. But then, with the abolition of chattel slavery, they could bring in new forms, sophisticated forms of slavery,
Yeah, and start the process of multiculturalism as well, of course.
Yeah, which is again all these. I mean, again, you sound like when you start pointing this out, you sound like a crazed anti-Semite as you characterize you. But if you look at all these. Whether it's abortion, pornography, multiculturalism, all this transgender nonsense, there's a heavy Jewish hand behind all these things. And the fact that they brag about it, you can get banned, you can be called an anti-Semite, you can get kicked off YouTube for merely quoting things that Jewish people say about these issues.
I know firsthand because I lost my original YouTube channel they don't actually have the honor to tell you the reasons, but it just one day it was just deleted and that was it.
Yeah,
but I had about 40 videos that I'd made on including on these issues regarding Jewish power and stuff, so I know very much firsthand. But you only have to look at the executives running these corporations, don't you?
They more or less have like an ADL compliance officer and all these things. There was a case where have you heard of the Proud Boys?
I haven't, no.
It's just a group of, self-defense, self-improvement guys. I guess that you could call them white, but they're really not. There's Hispanics in them and all that. But they're like right-wing, but they're not really violent. But they had a PayPal or some sort of funding mechanism through Citibank. And the ADL put them on their list. And then a report called Citibank, or either it was Citibank or Bank of America, I forget, it said, this group is proclaimed a hate group by the ADL, and they have a payment process through your bank. What are you going to do about it? And they immediately cut them off, just based on that threat. And so why does ADL have so much? Given its sordid history, I mean, people the history of the ADL, why it was created in the first place, to defend a murderous Jewish pedophile. You know,
the ADL, isn't it? It's the ADL.
You know, but
exactly. What's his name? Frank. Leo Frank.
This gets in this other thing again: is this penchant of Jews to back, you know, causes. One thing is the civil rights. You can see it as revolutionary, I guess, in a certain context. But it's been admitted. And I think it was forget the name of the book. It's called Fatal Embrace. But he admitted Benjamin Ginsburg, Fatal Embrace, that the Jews would often they'll take up a cause if that cause. You know, in supporting that cause, it advances Jewish interests, you know. And so you could see that the civil rights movement had a lot of Jewish back. You know, it was organized, it was run by Jews. And this was a larger reaction to what occurred in the South when the good people of Georgia decided to prosecute Leo Frank for murdering, you know, 13-year-old girl Mary Fagan. Yeah. And it was payback for that. And that sort of marked the beginning of the so-called Jewish Black Alliance, and it lasted all the way into the '60s. But it's a sort of radicalism, this stuff. At the same time, they're also backing, you know, the big advocates of pornography and these things, sort of all these agents of cultural destruction. But they've always done it in the name of liberty, even free speech. The free speech movement, like at Berkeley in the '60s, and they all advocated free speech when it can be used to tear down institutions and deconstruct institutions. But when it comes to free speech is employed by the other side for maybe propping up or defending or rebuilding institutions or just opposing Jewish interests, all of a sudden they become advocates of censorship. You know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, it seems to be completely acceptable, and we see it all the time. Is Jewish people talking about what is in the interests of Jewish people? You know, but when do you ever hear sort of a white person saying, well, this is in the interests of white people? Like, for example, it might not be in the interests of white people to import, you know, millions of Muslims who, who are stirred up with hatred for you and your culture because of what they perceive your people have done to them in the Middle East, for example. Mm-hmm. You know what? But you know, there's no reflection of, you know, there's. Obviously, it's just another example, and double standards, isn't it? You know, everything that's happening is a horrible double standard. But you mentioned the Leo Frank case. You know, prominent Jews across the whole of America were jumping to Frank's defense. Mm-hmm. They weren't there. They didn't see what happened. They didn't know if he was innocent or guilty. But because he was Jewish. He was able to muster the support of an entire community, you know, and an organization was founded in his support. But
and they bribed the governor.
You know, we don't see like if a white person is accused of raping a child, raping and killing a child. We don't see white people up and down the country saying, "Well, this guy was white, so this is just oppression against white people because white people don't do this," you know, and all this stuff. No, it's just, you know, it's so transparently biased and you know, completely regardless of the facts. I mean, you know, you can only come to the conclusion that the people that jumped to Frank's support really didn't care if he was guilty or innocent. It's more about just defending the interests of the tribe, and that's all.
And he was the head. Frank was the head of the local B'nai B'rith chapter. So Freemasonry, defending a brethren. But all Jewish power was mobilized to defend Leo Frank against Georgia, and they characterized Georgia as being anti-Semitic when really the South.
Anti-pedophilia and murder.
And actually, the South was philo-Semitic, if anything. Mm. I mean, for Pete's sake, Judah P. Benjamin, the Confederacy, the Treasury Secretary, was Jewish, and you had a huge Jewish population. Not huge, but a very influential, wealthy Jewish population in the South, South Carolina area. Mm. But this wasn't the case. But it was characterized as such. And that's because of that. And they were able to, all the newspapers were able to organize, this, again, an example of I think it was Adolf Ox. I think it had ran the Times at the time. He was brought into it to rally behind Frank, and Randolph Hearst was threatened to lose advertising if he didn't do it. Rally Leo Frank, and then they bribed the governor to commute his sentence, which is why Frank was lynched.
Yeah, exactly. You know, yeah,
Slayton, I think, was the governor. Then he went on he got the hell out of Georgia, went to New York, and went out like
because they knew what he'd done.
Yeah, yeah. And so, even, I mean, I remember that story. I didn't know anything about the Leo Frank case until I saw like an HBO movie about it, and it was completely pro Frank. And then I started reading about it. I was like, wait a second. I was like, you can't believe what you see on TV.
I mean, it's a great example of, well, you know, it's a great point to make regarding the foundation of this, organization, isn't it? You know, what it was really founded to do, which was to defend a child rapist and pedophile.
But Gus, the larger question is, given the reality of Zionism and its claims, and given the relation to Jewish people to Zionism, to Israel, and given, you know, what people have said, people like, Zionist leaders have said, is that there is an inherent problem regarding loyalty in Jews in your country because of the claim that Jews must be primarily loyal to Zion, which is Jews as opposed to their country, and they see themselves as a separate group. Given that reality, and that's obvious, other people have written about it. I've read articles by people who really you'd think are cool-headed, strategists, to say there is an inherent problem, a question of loyalty between Jews and when they're serving in government or hold positions of cultural or economic influence in your community, which speaks to that issue of should there be official protections, restrictions in your host country, given the nature of this people? And that's a very difficult question because it's so unliberal.
Yeah, exactly. Illiberal, I mean, it kind of comes down to me to what is a nation? What actually is a nation? It's a people of like culture, like beliefs and sort of a like understanding of how we treat each other, sort of thing. And that almost exclusively comes from a shared religious belief. And that obviously the destruction of the religious influence and in any nation makes these nations sort of multicultural and this kind of thing. But it makes, I mean, that's why all these nations are separate, in the first place, so that you, with your people who think like you, that act like you, that have each other's backs, you are together and safe together, away from people that might be directly a threat to you, sort of thing. But all the threats have been imported and mixed into the whole sort of melting pot, multicultural Western society. So, you know, we don't have nations anymore, do we? I mean, we have just this mess of people that's been put together to create chaos, really, and to destroy the people whose home it used to be. In my opinion, so people have lost the idea of nation, and all these kind of terms like nation, but things like. Things like gender and things like the idea of someone transgendering is just so ridiculous. Like, there's no gender is inherent to a person. You can't just change gender. You can change. You might be able to pass, by appearance as the other gender, and you might be able to chop your genitals off and mutilate yourself, but you're not going to change your gender. And the same thing with, for example, regarding, the whole broadening of the definition of sex and sexuality and sexual and things. Anything to do with sex is sort of, completely inseparable from reproduction. You have sexual organs that are designed to be reproductive organs, sort of thing. So there's no such thing as there's no such thing as a homosexual. There's no such thing as homosexual sex. You know, all these sort of terms have been completely transformed by the establishment in order to give some sort of equality between, various other types of non-sexual intimacy, if you like, to put it in the kindest possible way, and actual sexual intercourse, which can produce children, sort of thing. So we have this sort of, you know, age-old attack on language, I'm going off on a bit of a rant here, but for example, like marriage, for example, that people are saying, oh, well, why can't gay couples, why can't same-sex couples, get married? And obviously it's been legalized in a large chunk of the world, and in all Western countries, if I understand correctly. But the whole point of supporting marriage as a legal entity is to actually support the children that a marriage can create. It's not to support the two people getting married, solely. It's because this union can produce children, which are the future of any nation, sort of thing. So, we're just being subjected to this sustained attack on all these definitions to make it seem like there is some sort of equality between things that are inherently completely unequal and or even impossible,
Love is love, and would you deny two men a church wedding? That's it. I mean, that's the thing. They've separated society from the moral order. At the same time, they're appealing to our Christian sensibilities or our sentimentalism, rather, is a better better word, because people lose connection to the objective. And also to the moral center, and that's what they've done with promoting sexual liberation, homosexuality. Then they bring in the sentimental appeal. They did this in Ireland. I just read an article about how Google conquered Ireland in the recent edition of Culture Wars, written by E. Michael Jones. And there was a strategy for legitimizing homosexuality in Ireland that took a couple decades, but it was done by the Atlantic Foundation, a foundation, NGO, and they spent millions of dollars in Ireland using social media with messaging. Back in the 90s, there was a book called After the Ball. It's about strategizing the normalization of homosexuality in America. And it stressed the gradual promotion of homosexuality in the media, not by promoting. You remember in the 70s, sexual liberation, gay liberation was about, excess, hanging out at the disco, doing what I want. In the 80s, the consequences came clear with AIDS, when people's immune systems collapsed because of the lifestyle. But in the 90s, it developed, the way you normalize homosexuality is you appeal to people's sentimentalism and you normalize it. You make it an issue of equality and love. And that's why you hear this, love is love, even though no one defines with a word love. I love ice cream, I love my wife. It's not the same thing, but that's the manipulation of English language. This Atlantic Foundation is what he did was they would appeal to Irish Catholic sensibilities and sentimentalism. At the same time, they're being the Irish people themselves are being alienated from the church because of the church scandals, the scandals in the church. So the church is being weakened and marginalized. They studied the vulnerabilities of the Irish population, and it was James Joyce who called Ireland a priest-riddled society. Meaning that people were devotionally Catholic, but they weren't really, they didn't have a strong intellectual understanding of the natural law and Catholic doctrine. You're just told what to do. So in the clerisy, the clergy had scandal, and the clergy lost its credibility. They had nothing to fall back on. So in the 90s and 2000s, they had this campaign in Ireland that said, here's a 90-year-old grandmother, and the commercial would have, I have five kids, and I want them all to be married, and they have one gay child. Shouldn't they be married too? You see the appeal? It's all about fairness. At the same time, if gay couples can marry, they should also be able to have kids.
Well, exactly.
So now they're now comes now
with marriage, isn't it?
Yeah. So now they can adopt kids, and what that really means is they can buy kids.
Yeah. Well, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. And and then the pharmaceutical companies love it because they make a lot of money off sexual dysfunction, the drugs people take, particularly the transitioning thing. There's a huge market in pharmaceuticals with that. And so it's really vicious. And it's really, it's really Talmudic in the final analysis.
Yeah.
So
exactly. Well, you know, at least it's much more at the forefront in the West these days than in sort of, for example, Muslim countries. So I don't really know where it's going to end up. But we seem to be heading towards the, you know, like almost forced androgyny sort of thing. You know,
yeah,
forced, you know, the de-sexing of people at birth. You know, the forced equality between people at birth sort of thing, and the removal of any sort of natural right to procreate. You know, as a as opposed to the government sanctioned, for money or whatever, or government authorized delivery of children to approved couples sort of thing.
And the neuroses it creates, the pathologies it creates, are then treated by drugs or by ersatz identities. You mentioned that. You know, if someone has a strong identity, like I'm a German, I'm French, I'm Catholic, or I come from this town, and here's my family, here's my clan, then I'm not going to be given these fake identities in their products. And they know when they shatter these identities, they shatter these institutions or these connections, the organic bonds that people are going to seek identity elsewhere, and they seek it. And also in such shattered communities, you can have people who are so psychologically harmed because they're going to be abused. They're going to be sexually abused more often. They're not going to have proper role models. And all this was foreseen decades ago. It's a very sophisticated understanding of human psychology, human nature. It's very vicious, like in the authoritarian personality, which was published by the American Jewish Committee, that if you, it said that, fascism or, the Führer, idea of the Führer comes from the father figure of the family. So in order to fight fascism and prevent fascism, you have to destroy the family. And you destroy the family through by weakening the father and promoting sexual degeneracy. And that's been unleashed, from top down throughout the West. I mean, largely by Jewish-run corporations, Jewish-run Hollywood and advertising firms.
Yeah, completely. Completely. There's no strong male, figures at all. They're all presented as, you know, idiots or completely immoral, you know, or drunkards, gamblers, as you say, like sexual deviants and whatever, pervert sort of thing, you know. So,
and the only happy couples are gay couples on television.
The hero is always the gay guy.
And everyone's gay, by the way. It's like you walk around, you're like, I'm not seeing these people all around, but if you watch television, you think every other person is gay. It's being normalized. I watch it. That sort of theme is injected into TV shows and movies, which are completely unnecessary. And, you know, I watch it. I have a gag reflex. But the younger generation watches it, where it's been gradually normalized, they have a less of a gag reflex than the successive generation just accepts it. And really, the objective here isn't to make everyone homosexual per se. It's to make everyone think like a homosexual, meaning they're engaged in meaningless, sterile, episodic sexual relationships. It's not a big deal, as so many kids say now. And that's the difference. Whereas my generation, when I was a kid, it was like, ew, that's disgusting. That is really weird. A lot of people, teenagers and kids and young people in their 20s are very indifferent to it. And that's the revolution.
Yeah, and from indifference, it's not that difficult to push them into full involvement either. You know, like, because there aren't any, because there isn't any interest in this kind of research. But I would like to, see the proportion of people that define themselves as sort of homosexual and what their rates of vaccination and things like this are as well. Because, it's not that I don't believe that someone's quote unquote sexuality is completely inherent and destined from the moment of conception, sort of thing, as we're supposed to believe. I think there's all sorts of external factors that can affect someone's sexuality, if you like. So
yeah, you can screw someone up a lot if you want to.
Get them to do anything. You can get them to do absolutely anything, and obviously, it wasn't that long ago that people who, that men who decided they wanted to chop the penises off were called mad and put in the insane asylum. But these days, they're called, brave pioneers of a new world and given their own TV shows.
Oh yeah, or like we had a controversy here. A lot of these social issues are played out in the military services in the United States, because this is where you can again affect a lot of change, because it'd be done through executive orders, and so it's very political. But you know, we had back in the 90s, we had the homosexuals in the military issue. You know, then you have, you know, it's gotten a lot worse, where just a few years ago, President Obama had an executive order allowing transgendered people in the military services. And then, because this is where politics steps in, Trump gets elected and reverses that. So now we have this controversy, and now we have all these people arguing about this nonsense. Meaning, someone who isn't sure what sex they are, was that removed from reality, is not competent to serve in the armed forces. But it's portrayed as a lifestyle choice. And you know, apparently someone, and for the other side says that this should not be a reason not for someone to serve in the armed services. You know, this is how far we've gone.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's all theater, isn't it? Everything that comes out of politics is just theater.
And that debate, again,
close inspection, I mean, Trump's family are a little bit suspect.
Yes, yeah.
Close inspection, you know.
Just the fact that we've been having that debate is psychological warfare. You know?
We're supposed to, you know, the things that Trump purports to believe in, and the things that people like Boris Johnson purport to believe in, these things are on their way out. I think these are individuals designed to be destroyed along with the ideas they're supposed to hold. Sort of thing. You know, like nationalism, separatism, if you like. Obviously Boris Johnson's the Brexit guy. You know, he's supposed to get us free from the European Union, and you know, he's supposed to be British. But if you actually look at him, he's an American Jew on his mum's side, and on his dad's side, he's a Don May Muslim Jew. Mm-hmm. So
he was the mayor of London for a while, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was. Yeah.
He was a big advocate of immigration .
Yeah. And he's, you know, like, I mean, I've grown up in Britain, so I've watched his political career, you know, as I've been growing up, sort of thing. And he's always been presented in a quite special way by the British press as a future prime minister, and as a sort of there was something clearly different about him than your average thing. And it was no surprise to me at all that that he became prime minister. And I don't think it's a surprise to anyone, because he has been talked in that vein for a long time. So I think, you know, his whole political career up to this point has been training for whatever mission he is there to complete. And I don't think, you know, the best interests of the British people is his agenda. You know, I think there's so much chaos that they can create, because they have all these loaded weapons that are pointed at us, like the economy, like the immigration issue, like Brexit. So many different things they can use to wreak chaos, it's worrying times. You know, some people are getting kind of enthusiastic about Brexit, as if it's sort of, you know, a resurgence of nationalism and this kind of thing. But let's look at who has, you know, who's behind this entire agenda. It's the people that are working very obviously to destroy us. So why should we get excited in a positive way about this whole Brexit fiasco? What I think it gives them an opportunity to do is to wreak chaos, and of course whatever chaos is unleashed will be blamed on the kind of people that would vote for Boris Johnson and that would vote for Brexit, and that is obviously the white British majority, as is backed up by all the statistics. You know, it's the major cities where there's the most multiculturalism, the most immigration, if you like, that are the most left wing and that have Labour candidates. It's the white areas that tend to have voted Conservative, especially in this latest election. So So, you know, we know where the blame's going to go. It won't be any fault of the British people, for whatever's going to happen, but they're certainly going to get the brunt of the blame. And I think, you know, the same applies with Trump, you know, and the people that are going to support Trump. You know, they're going to get the blame for whatever chaos is done in the name of Trump, sort of thing. But, you know, like it's clear that he's just a player. You know, he's an actor. He's a, you know, as they all are, really. Politics is just a, you know, it's a theatre for actors, isn't it? You know,
it's a Hollywood.
A little more than that. You know, I don't think there's any genuine politician, you know, there. The doors are closed to anyone that, you know, wants to, you know, step off the street and do the best for their community. You know, they might be able to become a councillor, but, you know, they'd be lucky. But becoming a member of parliament, or especially a leader of a member of parliament, or, you know, in the cabinet or whatever, forget it. You know, you've got absolutely zero chance. It's a closed shop. So I don't think there's any reason for optimism about Brexit. And I think that, there's a very good reason to prepare for the unleashing of chaos, frankly. And there's a very gloomy perspective on the whole thing. And, you know, there might be, in a way, it might be seen as sort of slightly reassuring that so many people would vote against, the far left sort of thing. You know?
Yeah, it's like as opposed to Trumpism, you know.
Yeah, but it's kind of clutching at straws, really, you know, for positives to take out of it, to be absolutely honest, in my opinion.
Well, you know, they say politics is Hollywood for ugly people.
Yeah, there you go.
And there was, of course, Benjamin Disraeli, who was a Rothschild agent.
Yeah.
In his book, Königsby, he wrote, the modern world is governed by persons far different than is imagined by those who cannot see what is going on behind the scenes.
He's not wrong.
That's the 19th century. So.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. So. This has been going on a very long time. And, you know. I mean, you know, like the Rothschilds, before Mayor, was it Mayor Amstel Rothschild? He sent his sons to the five cities of Europe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they must have had sufficient control of German affairs at that point for that to be done, in my opinion. So, you know, their dominance over the economies of Europe and, you know, is going on for many centuries.
Well, it's the manipulation of finance, and this is sort of the Faustian bargain that maybe we take when we develop sophisticated economies and money, and it does allow for economic development, improved material standards of living, but it also opens up for much manipulation. And if you have people acting in bad faith, which unfortunately we do, you know, they engage in alchemy. And I think it was George Soros' book is called The Alchemy of Finance. At the end of the day, alchemy is a fraud. It's a con. You know.
Yeah. Well, I think it was Hjalmar Schacht's autobiography was called like the Wizard of Finance or something like this.
It's always this,
you know, it's all this Freemasonic wizardry kind of metaphors all over the place, isn't it? You know.
Mm-hmm.
They make really no well, for people who can actually read what they're saying for what it really is, they, you know, there's lots of boasting going on.
Yeah, a lot of boasting about ripping people off, which is very Talmudic. I mean, the idea is that if someone is unsophisticated or naive, that you, because they're not, buyer beware, right? Is that you have a right to, it's justified. It's the marketplace to rip them off. And that isn't even the case either, because when push comes to shove, is they're behind the scenes manipulating, stealing, and, you know, engaged in all types of fraud and, you know, so it's not just that, but the idea that, you know, it's, you know, why can't I sell a loan to somebody if they don't know what compound interest means? You know, why can't we sell off our children to debt bonds by sending them to college?
You know? Well, it's the kind of mentality of that's in the Talmud of if you find a goyim in the well, or like, you know, trapped down the well, you can get them out of the well as long as they promise you money, or you can take their money and just leave them in the well, and, you know, this kind of thing. You know, it's a hilarious document for examples of these kind of just cruel sort of spiteful, vicious behaviors towards others, you know. And this is why, really, we can't, you know, when we see, obviously, the political arena is ostensibly not that Jewish. You know, there aren't that many like openly Jewish people in politics, because at the end of the day, to understand the direction of society, most people look at the political system for the people that are making decisions. And when they see not many Jews there, they don't think Jews have any influence, really, or they don't think their influence is very great. But the reality is that I think, you know, politics is a crypto Jewish theater, because when you look at all the other organizations that are very powerful, look at, you know, Google, Facebook, look at the banks, you know, look at the media companies, whatever, the people that that run things behind the scenes, that your average person never looks into, they're very, very predominantly Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
But in politics, it's not the case. So so you have to think that understanding just the kind of
are corporations
affinity. Yeah, exactly.
Do corporations constitute a golem?
Yeah, well, understanding the affinity that the Jewish people have with themselves, we can't really think of anyone that is ostensibly Catholic, ostensibly Protestant, ostensibly Muslim, ostensibly Quaker or whatever, as being genuine to those actual beliefs, because we know that, you know, this establishment don't trust and don't don't promote people that aren't on their, you know, for their cause, mm-hmm. not for anyone else's, but for their cause. So, you know, it just does, you know, like, I mean, you know, like, for example, you know, the Barclays Bank is set up by Quakers, same as Lloyd's Bank and these kind of things. You know, I think a lot of these kind of denominations have been Jewish creations as well, sort of thing, that have served the purpose of making it seem that certain industries or the political system or whatever isn't entirely Jewish run.
Well, the entire financial system has become Jewish, so.
Yeah.
You know, it's Talmudry, financial Talmudry. But I ask you the question, you know, the hide behind corporations and the idea of corporate personhood, is a corporation, does a corporate person, does that constitute a golem?
I'm not sure what you mean by that.
Meaning
exactly.
That you have this entity created that has all the rights of an individual, but no responsibility.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Now, going back, and this is a court case in the United States dating back to the 1870s, the Santa Clara decision. I'm just looking back, you know, it's like you have an entity that has all the rights and privileges of every individual, but none of the responsibility. It's definitely sociopathic. So you have that corporate structure created with banking. You create an entire financial system, which is completely exploitative and intentionally unstable, because they can crash, they can pump and dump and crash, because pumping and dumping is how they take over a country, because they can drive the property up, get everyone invested, and then buy everything up at a song when the economy, that's what they did in Ireland, you know.
Yeah.
And you can have, again, alchemical, you can corrupt the culture. You can look how they corrupted Germany here. Japan, another example of what they did with the economy in Japan in the 80s, so in the 90s. It had a profound effect on Japanese society. It may have contributed to its demographic eclipse, because the pressure of people aren't getting married anymore. But it's just one of those things, you know. It's
I think alchemy is a great way of explaining it. You know, they literally print paper notes and use them to exchange for gold.
Yes,
they create gold out of thin air. You know, like, as far as they're concerned, and they have, you know, probably collected most gold on the planet. Yeah. I would suggest.
And we can write loans out of money that doesn't exist, and then get the collateral that's real. That's real value.
Yeah, you know, exactly. Yeah.
That's what a loan is. That, you know, when you make a loan, they create the money for the loan, then they get it's backed up by the collateral, which is usually real property, and then if the loans go bad, they can collect on the property. And the final analysis, even the smaller banks may fail, they're absorbed by the larger banks in the process, which are owned, you know, by a few handful, you know, families, you know, with the Rothschilds perhaps being at the top, you know.
Yeah.
So it's
I'm not even sure about that, to be honest. I think the Rothschilds are a convenient focal point for,
it's like a brand
dissatisfaction
name
or whatever. A little bit like George Soros, you know.
I think to take
the flack that is actually deserved by a much broader group of people.
Yeah,
actually, it's not, you know, it's if the Rothschilds didn't have, you know, like, you know, assuming that, I actually don't believe that, assuming they do run things, if they didn't have a huge, you know, a whole international army of people working to their objectives, they wouldn't be powerful. But they are, you know, they are powerful because they've got so many, they've got a whole diaspora of,
yes,
comrades, basically. Yeah.
Well,
but, you know, I think some, you know, because they want people to think that, sort of, you know, the quote unquote Jews are basically white. So they want to, you know, the Rothschilds are placed there as, you know, German Jews, they're European Jews, yeah, they're basically white, you know, and you know, but actually, you know, a lot of the other families that have had significant influence over, you know, throughout history, you know, people like the Sassoons, for example.
Yeah, the opium trade.
And I've looked into a family called the Dangours, which are really interesting because the sort of patriarch of that family, who's dead now, he declared himself as the exilarch of the Jewish people, and he wrote they're Babylonian Jews,
mm-hmm,
and David Dangour now has just received a very prestigious prize for sort of faith inclusion and all this, a prize that was also won by the Queen and the Pope and things. So the Dangours are another family to really look into, and they're just like the Sassoons, they're actually Sephardic and have their roots in Babylon. So I think maybe actually the very head of this synagogue of Satan, society actually comes back to Babylon and those ancient Babylonian families, in my opinion, of which the Rothschilds may well be originally part of, to be honest, but because obviously they have, you know, there's been a lot of interbreeding between them and the Sassoons, mm-hmm, at least ostensibly, and things like this, but, you know, but it's I think it's quite convenient for the you know, obviously it's very convenient for the Jewish people to present themselves as more or less white, you know, because they often try and pass as white, and they often, you know, pretend that any focus on the difference between white people and Jews is just sort of petty sort of thing.
Yeah. You
know? So I think it serves their interest in that way, but it's not quite the whole story.
Well, like I said, at the end of the day, the modern world is governed by persons far different than is imagined by those we cannot see what is going on behind the scenes.
Yeah, thanks, Ben. I agree.
Alan, I had you hour 45 minutes. Anything else?
No, that name that I forgot initially, the guy that did a talk on the connection between the Zionist movement and the Jewish mafia is a guy called Myron Sugarman.
Okay.
And he's done a couple of talks recently, and he's written a book that I won't be buying, but but his interviews are very interesting. So you can find him, his interviews on YouTube, and they're really fascinating. And he whinges about anti-Semitism while saying,
yes,
that they're so, yes, but what they gathered a great bunch of Jewish thugs to go and beat up anyone anti-Semitic sort of thing. And then whinges about people saying nasty things about them, like that they're a bunch of thugs.
it's all laudatory, but they're admitting everything that that we're saying. It's the funny thing. It's like when Harvey Weinstein gave a speech saying, "We need to act like the mafia." <That's> like, okay. I think they already got that cut. And you invented it, buddy.
Yeah. I mean, one thing I did just want to sort of touch on, I suppose, is the obviously the big influence of at least ostensibly Irish people in American politics as well. You mm-hmm. know, we have lots of important families, especially in New York, that have been mayors of New York, and obviously families like the Kennedys and things mm-hmm. with their roots in Ireland. And I wonder if lots of the crypto Jews that came to Ireland became sort of Irish, adopted Irish names, then went on to you know, travel out to the United States and become influential people there. And this is an area of research that I haven't really delved in great detail into as of yet. But this, you know, I think it's interesting to speculate on that being the case, and that. Yeah, the official numbers, as we've mentioned in Ireland, are so low with regard to the Jewish community, and their influence seems so high that we can quite, you know, I think, you know, it's not crazy to speculate that there might be a lot of crypto Jewish families active in Ireland today, and that some of those families, as Irish, will have been. Would have traveled to the United States and become influential there as well.
Yeah, well, it's a strategy that dates back to the 15th century at least. So, you know.
Yeah, lots of the. I think there was a big wave of immigration after the 1497 expulsion from Portugal, and quite a few of those Jews ended up in Ireland as well. And in fact, I think one of the there was a mayor in Ireland that was there as early as, I think, 1555 or something like this. And then his son became mayor as well. And these were Sephardic Jews that had been, kicked out of Portugal. So yeah, it's been going on a long time, you know, with all the name changing and cloak and daggers and, you know, smoke and mirrors and all that. It's hard to get real information. But I think there's enough, you know, there's enough kind of official information there to use to create pretty solid, a pretty solid case for what's going on.
Yeah, and yes, and also the issue of the culture itself being Judaized, and you have a lot of you know, you can say Irish Catholics, they'd be, you could say they are Americanized Catholics, and so then in that case. It might not make much of a difference in the final analysis, considering what America is. So, okay, well, I'm going to let you go now. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Tim. Thanks so much for having me on. And Happy New Year to yourself and to your audience. And I hope to speak to you again sometime. It's been quite a while since last time. And I really, really enjoyed our discussion. So thank you.
Oh, you're certainly welcome. Happy to you too. And I'll let you go. And I'll post as soon as I do. I'll send you the link.
Brilliant. Thank you.
Great. Good night then.
Great. Good night. Bye. Bye-bye.